Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
Hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm gonna stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net. We're also at IHateCritics.com, EveryonesAcriticPodcast.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handles there are CriticsPod. If you want to participate in our top fives, watch trailers, read reviews, interact, that's where you can go. And there's also a Facebook group called Everyone's a Critic Podcast, our movie review podcast maybe. Another place where you can interact, and you get everything we do. Every time someone posts anything, you get an annoying message on your phone unless you turn that off. So
please don't turn that off.
I mean, sometimes some of us work late or do things late at night on occasion. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, all the podcatchers. We are on most of those as far as I know. No matter where you listen to us, so please go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, we'll read the review on the air. And then Patreon, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. And you get a credit on the show, among other things. Uncle Jeff threatened to pull away our Patreon support because I said I like Porky's better than Tootsie or something like that.
Well, and then he also claimed that somehow your list in 1985 should be reversed, that Out of Africa should be first. And let me tell you, if you ever need a good, like, 3.5 hour nap during the day, just start Out of Africa, and then about 15 minutes in, you'll be ready for that nap.
Or if you can't fall asleep at night,
put it on. We love you, Uncle Jeff.
But, I mean, it won an Oscar, didn't it? So
yeah, it's Best Picture winner. It's just...
And Color Purple is good. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm sorry, Rocky IV and Rambo 2 and Back to the Future are phenomenal movies. Everything else is just okay. I guess I'll just bring up trailers I saw before Solo because they all seemed new for movies we've talked about. Ant-Man and the Wasp, was that a new trailer that we saw?
Because I had compared seen it to the before. First time we talked about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Yes, it
the
is
new est.
Yeah. Okay, and it looks like a Marvel movie. Skyscraper, that was a new. I mean, we've talked about all these movies. The other was Mission Impossible Fallout. I hadn't seen that trailer.
The Skyscraper trailer, I love The Rock, but this has got more of a San Andreas vibe than it does a Fast and Furious vibe to me.
Oh yeah, it even looked like it was a sequel for a few moments.
See, it has that Mount Everest vibe to me. It's like you can clearly tell this is a bad idea while you're building this.
Right.
So why do this movie shouldn't exist?
I wonder. I do wonder if this is maybe part of the Talking Cat universe, because that Nine Lives universe. Because Kevin Spacey was making that movie, and he was building the tallest building in the world. I wonder if this was the guy he kept talking about in that movie, who was up building the other tallest building in the world.
I guarantee this is the only movie show this week that's talking about a Nine Lives cinematic universe.
It'd be nice if Keanu had a universe.
There we go.
So there are your trailers. There was really nothing, unless there's something you guys saw that kind of stood out.
Mm-mm.
I keep seeing stuff about a movie that's coming out next week called Upgrade. Betty Gabriel from Get Out is in that, and it's directed by the guy who did the original screenplay for Saw.
Yeah.
One of the creators of Saw, Darren Lee Winnell. I'm not impressed by the trailer. I don't know who that star is, which is weird.
Logan Marshall Green from Prometheus.
But yeah, that's been kind of getting everywhere.
That's I hate that trailer. I really do. It reminded me of that third person shooter film that they made, like Hardcore Henry or something like that, except not first person. That's really what the whole vibe reminded me of. And I understand that Lee Winnell's got a following, including on this show. I mean, I know that you're a fan of what he's done, but boy, that is a terrible, terrible trailer. And the fact that it's called Upgrade, it's just got that. if it's cheesy fun, then I'm all for it. But I have a feeling that Lee Whannell thinks that he's really, really good at what he does, and he's not going for fun. He thinks he's great. So
I'll be fascinated to see the box office next week, because, I mean, Upgrade has been really going hard on social media in terms of getting it out there, whereas Action Point and Adrift have done very little outside of trailers.
That was the longest trailer that I saw before Solo, was for Adrift. It was almost like a 4 or 5 minute long trailer that included a lot of, from what I've seen from both trailers from that, and included a really good song too. It still doesn't make me want to see the movie right at all, but
yeah, that was a little bit longer than I, yeah. Very similar to the other trailers, but there was like a little moment of her being alone for a little longer than, yes, the trailer than, yeah, the other two trailers.
I'm still Adrift has got a long way to go with me to get over that whole, like how he reacted to Everest. Like, yeah, I get it. I get why you want to do that, but I don't feel bad that you're gone because you did this to yourself. My sympathies are not necessarily with you.
Boy, if only we'd made Into the Wild the classic next week. Could have put that argument right
that
up
was
against
poignant,
mine.
Though. This is not even a true story, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it is?
Just a true story. I'm sure it's 100% accurate, too. do we stick with the box office, or do we just move on to our movies?
Well, I mean,
because that is part of the story.
Yeah, the box office, yeah, it's probably the biggest story in movies today.
Solo's only going to make $100 million. Oh, no. It's opening week. $400 million overall, $100 million more than the budget.
It's a complete flop.
Which
a
is
a disaster.
It's a profit making flop. But it's, I don't know. I think that's a good thing for the Star Wars universe. I don't think it's going to shut them down, but it might allow them to be smarter, quit switching directors all the time, giving a little bit smaller budgets, more creative control. I don't know.
I'm a little surprised at the box office. There was something to say about people boycotting this film too, those in the Star Wars fandom. I heard a little bit of that, and the person that I know, we mutually know him, his name's Chris, lives in the Quad Cities here. He's a big cosplayer, very serious about it. I happened to see him right after coming out of his showing of Solo, and he was ecstatic about it. We'll get to our opinions on it in a moment, but to have the guy that's the biggest Han Solo fan that I've ever seen really like it and not boycotting it. Because when I saw him at The Last Jedi, he was talking about boycotting this film and not having any interest in it at all. I think that there is something of a backlash against this for whatever reason. I mean, I thought people might get over their fanboy feelings a little bit for Han Solo. I mean,
right.
But this goes back to Bob's opinion of this fandom, which he's not, you're not wrong about that, Bob.
I know,
there with
I'm 100% right. I've been right from the beginning.
A good portion of the fandom, yes.
That fandom is at times, as lovely as that idea of fandom might be, it can be kind of toxic. And this is kind of that toxic reaction that is totally not necessary.
But most of it's over. The biggest problem is the foreign box office, not so much. I mean, it's not great here, but It full-on flopped internationally.
Well, China, right?
I don't know. It made $65 million overseas. And that's not good for that.
For a tentpole like this to not equal at least what it did domestically is kind of a surprise. And it fell short of Disney's own expectations of $100 to $130 million. So any time that somebody puts out a number and they expect that and it falls far short of that, I'm not surprised by the thought that it's a flop, but it's not going to be a flop. And I think that this has a lot of, having seen it, has a lot of replayability in the Blu-ray, you know, on-demand market. I think this is something that's, we'll get to it in the film, of course, but being breezy in the way that the film is, I think it'll play well on video.
I think what you're going to see, though, when in future movies like this, and that you do need somebody who has a name. And we'll love Woody Harrelson, but in terms of box office international, he's not a name. But I bet if you figured out a way to have, I don't know, because Sam Jackson's already in the Star Wars universe, but somebody of that type of actor who has some stature worldwide, you'd bump that up a little bit.
But that would just
There's just nobody in this movie who has that kind of power, who has that kind of recognition, and that plays big internationally, is having that level of recognition.
Well, yeah, I think they were trying to work on the Star Wars recognition and the name Han Solo. What were they boycotting for? I mean, Because of the last movie?
Because of the last film, it was so divisive to the point where people are upset at Disney for making the wrong kind of Star Wars film. Oh, all right, well.
Okay.
Whatever.
That's fair.
But there's also, I think there's a smaller part of that that is also a reaction to Lord Miller and the behind-the-scenes stuff that went on. Not that there's a big Lord Miller faction out there, but I'm saying there are people who, like, this used to express itself back in the day of just lots of trade paper bickering. Variety and Hollywood Reporter would go back and forth with reports, and that would get out to a small portion of hardcore film nerds who would, you know, take sides with the filmmakers, and usually, oftentimes, it would actually end up sinking a movie that way. And this one doesn't get sunk, but it's a different form of that same argument where people are like, well, this is a disaster because they had to reshoot the whole thing. I'm not going to waste my money. Or those who are on the other side going, well, I'm sure it was fine. I'll go check it out for myself and make up my own mind.
Right. And to that point, part of it doing bad, I think it's a good thing. It'll still be profitable, but you're not going to necessarily see them throw money. Because changing directors and whatever, that's a lot of wasted money. You're not going to see that happening as much when you're not going to guarantee to get it back anymore. Like, they just took for granted.
I imagine this would be a much much easier, much more profitable movie if they didn't have to do that. All that they had to redo in order to make that work. All these special effects they spent on Michael K. Williams to not have him in the movie.
All right, so what's your opinions?
Solo, of course, Alden Ehrenreich taking up the name Han Solo, and we're going back to his origin story as an orphan on Corellia, where he's got a girlfriend and he's trying to escape from, I guess, alien mobsters. He's got a plan, but he's interestingly enough, he doesn't actually have a name. He's just Han, and we find out how he's gonna get. We find out how he gets his name, and again, all this is kind of a weirdly compact thing. We take all of those things that they talked about in the first three Star Wars movies about Han Solo, and we pack them into, what, 3, 5, 10 days? It would seem like it's not a lot of time period where all that stuff that they talked about happened to him.
They take all your eye rolls and throw it into one short.
So we're going to see him meeting Chewie, the Kessel Run, Lando Calrissian, how he got the Millennium Falcon, all of that in this space of time that, for me, that was the hardest part to buy into, was that short space of time. That said, I like this movie. I think it's a solid adventure. I think taking out even the Star Wars stuff, which is hard, but if you look at it like that, it's a solid, well-made action movie. It's the kind of action movie that you expect Ron Howard to make. It's competent. It's professional. That's pretty much what he delivers, and it's hard to. I don't really have many. I don't have anything necessarily negative to say aside from that. Maybe the too compact storytelling is a little bit bothersome, but overall, it's just so solid and so competent that I like it enough.
You want me to go?
No, I do.
I this is the worst one I've seen in a long time. Star Wars wise. I think it's the worst-looking one that they've had in a while. It was just... I know a lot of the stuff they did was dark, but make up your mind. Either go way dark or show a little light, but this in-between crap got really annoying for almost the entire movie. but everything else, I can't take the Star Wars away from it. Sean's probably right. It definitely is... It probably, if you took that away, it'd be a solid action movie, and I shouldn't complain about it, but I wasn't as into it as I thought I would be. Or I guess I never really did. I guess from day one I've been saying this would be a throwaway Star Wars movie, and it kind of is. And if it's going to play well on Blu-ray with multiple viewings, it's kind of what it is. It's a popcorn Star Wars movie that's just kind of fun for the servicing the fans, but otherwise just kind of a movie that's out there. That's all I got.
Yeah, well, I've withheld my overall opinion to everyone up until this point, actually. I think that this is the third worst Star Wars film made. Attack of the Clones and Phantom Menace are just not competent films, let alone competent Star Wars films. And this one, just because it has things that are familiar in it, I'm upping the ante over those two pieces of garbage. This isn't really competent at all for me. I think that you can see that they didn't know what to do, and so they just threw something together that happened to follow a storyline. There's no reason not to go a little harder on all of this stuff, and I don't want to make the film a third time, but I kind of do. What is the Kessel Run, for example? It's a perfect microcosm of what's wrong with this film. They get out of this maelstrom, and if they want to say that that's the Kessel Run, where's the 12-part? What run are we talking about here? He went from point A to point B. There's no run. You're just flying. Okay? And if you're saying that from a certain point he got out of there within 12 parsecs, we don't see that on screen. If he's famous for that, that's the laziest piece of shit Kessel Run I've ever seen, okay? It's a microcosm of the whole film. We're supposed to be very impressed by notoriety alone. And I understand that that can really get somebody going, and that's fine. Congratulations to you. Dryden Voss is a terrible villain. Paul Bettany just gnarls in a British accent while he's on screen. I don't know why they decided to take Michael C. Williams. I can't remember the actor's name, but they remove him from the film for what? I still don't understand. I don't think I ever will understand. The scenes with Lando in it are probably the strongest for me. I really like Donald Glover, and he does a very good Billy Dee Williams impression sometimes. you can actually hear Billy Dee coming off in his inflection. But he keeps it just enough of his own for me to say that Donald Glover is taking this role and making it his own. Alden Ehrenreich, his voice is so different than Harrison Ford's that I really had a hard time seeing him as Harrison Ford. That is not his fault, of course. He's playing Han Solo the way that he thinks it should be played, and I have no argument with that. But I, of course, wanted this guy to be Han Solo, so I can't really complain about that since I wanted that. He's got the look. He's got the mannerisms mm-hmm. down. He's got the facial expressions down. But his voice is just a little off, and that kind of threw me out of the film a little bit. I don't know what that makes me, but it is a complaint that I have. Woody Harrelson is Beckett. He's playing just basic numbers here. There's nothing harder edged about him. And when there are double crosses involved, I'm not saying who is doing the double crosses, but trailer tells you who's that you not. Shouldn't trust anyone. It's all very lame and standard, and there's no risks taken by this film whatsoever. It's what I complained about with Ron Howard before. If you wanted the vanilla, you got the vanilla. Congratulations. The most excited I got in this entire film is a completely out of left field on-screen appearance by a character that we can maybe get into after the show if you guys are interested at all. I have a feeling that eye rolls are about to commence.
Well, I was wondering who that was. That the person from the first one?
I can't. If we say it, that's a spoiler. So,
well, everybody's boycotting.
He was in Phantom Menace.
Okay, so he's the one who died.
There are multiple characters from The Phantom Menace in this. There's a character from Rogue One in this.
Which confuses me, because that was like Darth Vader as a kid, right?
Yes.
And this is like right before Star Wars.
This is 5-6 years before
A New Hope. So yeah. Darth Vader is now a person.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people in the galaxy know who Darth Vader is, and they're scared of him. The Empire's trying to take over the entire galaxy, obviously, as we see through military operations in this. But
had it been mentioned before Han Solo's origin as a pilot? Had that been mentioned in the previous movies? I don't remember.
No, not in the films. There's a lot of stuff that they actually take from books in this. Tobias Beckett is a novel character that they bring to the screen. That's kind of very interesting that they would bother doing that. But the idea of Chewie and Han's meeting is not nearly as cool as it is in the books, where Han frees Chewie as a slave, okay? I mean, here he's kind of just like a prisoner that eats things.
Yeah, that was very thrown together way too fast.
And then all of a sudden they have chemistry. Again, this is what this whole movie is about is... Sean, you put it just right. All of the famous moments of Han Solo's life that we've been told about, all the legend of him is thrown within a span of perhaps a week to 2 weeks. That sucks. There's no reason why you have to do that. Even throwing in there meeting a vile gangster or whatever, we all know who that is, but it's all a it's a hodgepodge of Star Wars stuff that doesn't actually complete a film, and no fan service moments are really going to make me praise this at all.
I will say, though, that getting those things out of the way does open them up to create something that isn't constricted by our nostalgia and imagination for a second movie. Once you wipe away all the stuff that we know, it does open up opportunities to create new things with Han Solo that we weren't aware of. So I thought it was weird to come back to it all, I did find at least that little silver lining there that if they do make another one of these, there's room for them to get around the nostalgia and all the stuff that we've already imagined, which kind of holds this movie back a little bit, because we've already imagined what the Kessel Run was. We've already imagined what Han and Chewie's meeting was like and the game between Lando and Han. We've already imagined that stuff, and we had that going into this, and that kind of restricts what they can do with this. Because you don't want to break that continuity.
Yeah. Please go ahead and finish your thought. I'm sorry.
That's all right. So I find that silver lining. There are just a lot of things I like a lot about this movie. Like, I like the train sequence in this film. I thought that was a pretty spectacular action sequence. Even if it's not, it's just an action sequence. It's not important in any way whatsoever. It's just well crafted. I enjoyed that. Phoebe Waller-Bridge as the L7. Is that what?
Something like that.
She was fantastic. Just a hysterically funny character to me because she's such a great actress. I really enjoyed the weirdness of that and her weird chemistry with Donald Glover. I thought was hysterical. It's just such a weird touch, and I can only imagine how Lord and Miller would have played that. I would have really kind of liked to have seen them go real weird on that, because they would have.
I don't know. I mean, so basically he's fucking the robot, and they pretty much imply that throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And they even acknowledge it at one point, and it's just really, I don't know. And it wasn't that funny. I mean, I don't know. I didn't.
Thrown in there, it becomes kind of just like as opposed to something that's actually resonant. After the fact, it doesn't matter to us.
I didn't quite take it that way. I thought she was kind of playing that up because she's kind of a weird egotistical robot.
But
and they did have chemistry, but at the same time, I don't think it was necessarily that.
But they full on said, well, how did you do it? Oh, you can do it.
Right.
Yes. That was the line in the movie. And then on top of that, you have someone coming out calling, what's his name, pansexual, which means he'll fuck anything. So that's, I mean, just not good marketing. Sorry.
There's no problem for me making Lando presentable in the universe as a particular sexuality.
Right.
That's not the problem. It's more a matter of how they presented it.
Right.
You can't do that after the fact and then make the audience feel some kind of empathy for him. Well, we're finally understanding that you actually did have feelings for a robot after the fact. Then we didn't join you on that mission. so to speak.
That is so true.
I would like to take this back to Attack of the Clones. We were led to believe that the most famous romance of all time was Anakin and Padme. Like, those are the star-crossed lovers. They are the science fiction Romeo and Juliet. And George Lucas, it is literally the worst on-screen romance that I can think of. Literally. And he even brought in a writer to help him with those scenes. And it's still that terrible. I don't know what it is with Star Wars. And you're saying that the film is no longer constricted by these things, but I don't see any reason why they can't just film it as it's written already in canon. I understand that we don't have to make canon specific, but when the canon is so much better than what's on screen, then I'm going to go back and say, the Kessel Run matters. The Sabacc game between Lando and Han matters. If I want to go see a card game, I should be going to Star Wars and seeing a card game that's awesome, because there's no reason why they can't do that here. They have so many things that they can make up rules left and right for this game that we know nothing about. I'm going to go to Casino Royale and watch Bond play cards with Lashif. That's the coolest card scene I've ever seen on screen, okay? And love scene-wise, I'm going to go to Once or actual Romeo and Juliet or Shakespeare in Love or something like that to see a romance, and instead it should have been Anakin and Padme. What is wrong with these people that they can't make, within a world that has no constraints, they can't make a reasonable, even competent love story? Or
well, let's think of
you know,
the, I don't
I know I'm saying this because I'm very passionate about it. This is all crap in the movie, and they should have made it at least competent.
What's her name? Amelia Clarke. Mm-hmm. She's just not good at this.
She doesn't seem
comfortable at all. She doesn't seem to be relaxed at all.
Natalie Portman is.
Yeah. But she was also acting against a wall, basically. That guy wasn't actually there.
I guess let's get back to the...
Hayden Christensen is the worst special effect of all time.
But there is something to... I mean, there's a joke here. The reputation of Star Wars fans, and then the fact that they can't pull an on-screen romance off in a movie. I don't know. I think that's kind of funny.
But they have in the original trilogy. Han and Leia right. have actual chemistry. I mean, there's no Leia doubt about that. Of course. There's something real on the screen in that original trilogy. And I am not just simply talking about nostalgia here. It's good writing. It's competent, at least, acting. And instead, it's almost like the expectations are working against them, where they say, well, no matter what it is, they'll eat it up because there's Star Wars.
Back to the original trilogy, Lucas directed one of those, right?
Indeed.
That's kind of your canon, those three. Two and three are probably better than the first one, and then or five, whatever you, fucking number you want to throw on. Then he goes back and he kind of lays an egg three times, two and a half times, whatever. Then Disney buys it, does a fan service movie, takes a chance, or does one of these, a movie like Soul, Rogue One, which I actually thought was a pretty solid movie for a movie that you know everything that happens, but they do a good job of making... They're allowing enough nostalgia that... And if it doesn't matter, you're not making it for me, so who cares about nostalgia? Take these two, make two Solo movies and spread it out. I liked the card game scene in Solo, but it would have been better if it was longer and more.
Absolutely.
You could have made it better. And
that's
then,
the linchpin of your film, to me, is that at the end of the film, you need to have, instead of the short scene that they do show, that's like the Casino Royale scene where he finally gets... control of this thing. Like, how does it do it? This screenplay could have been, and this is by Lawrence Kasdan and Jonathan Kasdan, father and son team here. Lawrence Kasdan is the caretaker of Han Solo, for crying out loud. I don't know why they couldn't take this and make it the linchpin of the film. That would be unique. Instead of having some battle or something that requires, you know, space violence or whatever to happen to get you to the end of the film, some final battle. Solo, to me, is a character that is smooth enough, a Bugs Bunny-ish type character that can weave his way in through all of this dogma of Jedi this, blah, 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 and Sith this, to really come in and make a film that has cards in it is your climax of the film.
He really doesn't do anything. He never stops. He just keeps going.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, like, I think to your point, that would you could really do anything with that character because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had the germination of a real film by introducing the cameo, the real underworld of Star Wars that they hint at throughout this film. They've talked about 1, 2, 3, and they 4, if you count the vile gangster figures in this criminal underworld that they're only referencing here. And instead you show Paul Bettany multiple times on screen. It's just a total wasted. I have to be this excited and energetic about it. Otherwise, there's no point in me reviewing this film. So,
here's what we have coming up. We have Sallow, which, wait till we get there. Fahrenheit 451. Sean saw Best Friend Fiends, the second part of it. And then Crocodile Dundee 2 and Rambo 3. Let's just do our spoiler thing now. If you're going to see Solo, I'd assume you would have already done it already. If you're boycotting it, we'll just ruin it for you and when you get to Blu-ray. Because I don't know. I think we should. So that was Darth Maul.
Yeah.
The guy was cut in half.
The XFL football.
He's apparently Deadpool.
Well, let's think of the science of lightsaber cauterization, will you? I mean... There's no guts flying out in Phantom Menace, so okay, fine. The canon took that and said, oh, what if they attach spider legs to him? And there's some artwork out there you can find if you're really interested. But they
are not helping us here.
No, I'm trying. And when they bring him back in the cartoon, The Clone Wars, it's interesting because he's out of his mind. He's in this criminal underworld, right? And you're wondering, what are they going to do with this character? His horns have grown, like, a ton. He's wild, okay? And he was reined in by this by Emperor Palpatine or Darth Sidious or whatever in The Phantom Menace. Okay, let's just assume that he lives. Because you have to make that leap, otherwise there's no point in going with it. Then he's wild, he's out of control, but he wants revenge upon the Sith in the Clone Wars. He wants to kill Darth Sidious and Palpatine and Dooku and then Vader, you know? He's on it. He really hates all of them. Well, that would be really awesome to have, like, a third party wanting to destroy everyone from the inside. Crimson Dawn or Crimson Empire, anything that's like a third party in the Star Wars world kind of works neat because you've got another thing that you have to worry about instead of just Jedi versus Sith. That can be very boring and dogmatic. In this case, Darth Maul provides an interesting opportunity. They even have him with his legs there, and Ray Park is playing him, and they have Sam Witwer voicing him, and he does the voice of Darth Maul in the cartoons. It's all very neat, just that should have been early in the film. Why do you even need Paul Bettany? Put Darth Maul in there as your villain! Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, more or less. But still, in terms of putting the guy with the cool looking head and making him your main bad guy, that make more sense. And kind of to make, the XFL did die and now it's coming back, so it does kind of work. They look the same.
Oh my God.
They really do.
Phantom Menace and the XFL is kind of a good comparison.
Flaming bag of garbage.
And I think...
Phantom Menace was successful, though. Never mind. It's hateful as it is.
Is this the first thing that's the closest thing to unsuccessful from the Star Wars world?
It seems clear that that's the case. The opening weekend for Revenge of the Sith was around this time in 2005 and made $105 million in its first 4 days. So I would say that, yes, this is the closest thing to a failure that Star Wars will have.
Now, it's not that far away from the last one that just came out, Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. You got Avengers still fresh in the theater. You got Deadpool still fresh in the theater. And you got Jurassic World coming up, which is going to probably even slow this one down in the future. Is that really why this kind of, quote-unquote, bombed more than anything else?
I think switching from November to now was a huge mistake. I think they planted themselves in the wrong spot. I think they thought a little bit too highly of the Star Wars Solo name brand opposite, you know, the superheroes and dinosaurs, and maybe should have kept it where it was comfortable in that November slot. It's been kind to them the past couple of years.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anything that would have been bad about this film being released in Thanksgiving time or Christmas time this year, which, to be honest, the only thing that comes to my mind is Aquaman this year coming out around Christmas time.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure that there's more, but...
Well, I know, but that's... I don't know. I keep going back to the same thing. You don't have to spend a shit ton of money to make a good movie. If you make this more about a card game or more, you know, based on where the Solo's character really is, you could have done this really cheap. You don't need all the CGI. You need some of it. It's Star Wars, but you could have really torn it back. Yes, that train scene was neat, but completely pointless. It didn't really do much, but didn't even really move the story on. It just kind of happened.
Yeah.
At some point, you need to show Han Solo dealing with precious cargo. Okay,
correct.
And that's how that scene comes into play. But in other areas of the film, you've got the same product in a smaller sense, and you don't have to take on a speeding train.
Right. So there's ways you could have saved a lot of money, and then all of a sudden, this is really profitable. You know, if they ever do a Boba Fett movie, I don't even really know who that is. I just know you guys talk about him a lot. Not you, but the Star Wars geeks out there. I don't know, maybe you can't make that one cheap, but that one will bomb if you don't, so I don't know.
I heard this week via reputable Star Wars source, wherever they got it from, I don't know, but that director James Mangold is going to make a Boba Fett film. Okay, I'm cool with it.
He's the type of guy that would tone it back a little bit dollar-wise, isn't he?
I would think so. I mean, director of two Wolverine films, 310 to Yuma. Copland.
Copland. I mean, I don't know.
R-rated Star Wars.
Honestly, to make a... They're never going to do it, of course, but to make a criminal underworld film involving all these nefarious dudes, Boba Fett, Cad Bane, Aura Sing, Bosk, they name those people in the show, Lando, Han, Chewie, I'd watch the shit out of that, especially if James Mangold made it. Ron Howard, though.
Safe.
Yeah. Congratulations on your vanilla film.
Because everything Sean said is true.
Yeah,
if you take the Star Wars out of it, it's just an action movie that's pretty... It works in the way that a throwaway action movie works.
Yeah, it's a completely forgettable film. It's a less competent Serenity.
Anything else on Solo?
I liked it enough.
I haven't seen Attack of the Clones or Return of the... Whatever the Sith movie is.
Revenge
the
third of Sith, one.
Revenge. And then it's been a long time since I saw Phantom Menace, but in terms of everything else that I don't really care for anyway, this is my least favorite. So... I guess where would you rank it then? You liked it, but you also like other Star Wars movies. So where would you throw it?
I'd put it ahead of the three trilogy movies, but behind everything else.
So we're kind of all on the same.
Yeah.
I like Revenge of the Sith better than this, Rogue One better than this, Force Awakens, Last Jedi. I think this is 8 out of 10 for me.
Yeah,
I would consider the entire Clone Wars Rebels series better than this, too. Seriously.
Well, like Force Awakens pisses me off because it's just fan service, but make up your mind, do one or the other. You know, if you want to do a fan service movie, do it here. You do it, you could easily get away with it here on a fun little Lethal Weapon Crocodile Dundee type action movie,
because that's what Han Solo is like. Slightly disagree with you on The Force Awakens. Story wise you can make that argument, but they have no lines from Luke Skywalker in the film. I waited 30 years to see Luke goddamn Skywalker, and there's no Luke Skywalker. Okay. That's a bold move,
that
man.
Well, he's in it. A bold move would have been not having him there at the end, like I suggested when we talked about that way back when. And I've said it before, but it was literally like watching Full House when John Stamos walks in the door. The crowd cheered. Anytime any character that you recognize, or the Millennium Falcon, or any of those stupid things that popped up, the crowd went nuts. And that, I don't know, by definition, is fanservice. So it didn't service you all the way. You didn't quite finish, but you
got close. What you're saying.
Sorry. Fahrenheit 451, HBO.
Yeah, Fahrenheit 451, Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon, starring a story set in the future, which books have been outlawed and lots of information has been scrubbed from the new version of the internet to prevent these books from infecting people. The firemen are the people in charge of getting rid of all these books that keep turning up in various different places. Instead of putting out fires, they start them by starting books on fire. Michael B. Jordan is the young upstart fireman. Michael Shannon is the old guard fireman, and they're going to come into conflict when Michael B. Jordan gets his hands on a book for the first time and reads it and realizes the value of it, and this movie is not good to me. I didn't enjoy this. I think it doesn't really have a good enough idea of what it wants to say. At times, and again, this is probably just my political bias, but this movie puts forward a very silly notion of censorship it's those left-wing liberals who want to just ban every book that offends people, and that's why we got rid of Huck Finn, man, because they used the N-word in it, and we didn't want to offend your people, so we got rid of the book. And no, that's not true. That is just flatly not true. That's the path that you're going on. You're wrong about that. It's one thing to just you just criticize a book. I mean, when somebody labels something politically correct, they're just criticizing something for having been, you know, for having for basically being irrelevant or being genuinely offensive. And just because something is offensive doesn't mean you're going to ban it. You're just calling it what it is. It's offensive. But that's it. It's still widely available. You can go to Amazon right now and get Huck Finn, because nobody's banned it. Nobody's talking about banning it. You can still buy Mein Kampf, for fucking sake. It's not been banned. But this movie, I lost me that moment. The production design is very slick. The direction is slick. But there's really no substance to this because they don't really have a better idea than just political correctness is killing everything. And that's just a fucking silly notion.
I watched it, and I feel like the time has passed the story by.
Yeah.
The fact that books aren't even really readily available anyway. and now you're, you know, the scrubbing of the internet didn't really, it was just, I don't know, it just didn't work. You have, you know, competent actors and people, it just, the story just was not by, because I mean, yes, books are readily available, but I do think if you let certain people in charge, they would happily make things that offend them unavailable. Not everybody, but there's a select, you know, there's extremes.
Sure.
But I don't think, it just doesn't work today.
A college campus gets rid of a book in their library. They're not, the book is not banned. It's just not carried in that library anymore. Go somewhere else and get it. That's not a ban.
But now, I mean, pretty much the only place you can get information in this movie is through books, which is bullshit. You can get information almost anywhere now. And because it's in the future, which I haven't seen the original one or read the original book, but at least that's older, and you can at least put yourself in the mindset of that time, especially if it's good. Here, it's today, it's made for the future, and information comes from books. And it just, that's what took me out of the movie, and it just didn't work. And you make Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon look bad. It just, it was kind of a mess.
Yeah, and the way it plays out is so silly. It's just so ridiculously silly. Their plan to try and save the books or the information of world history is so convoluted, just like such the worst possible idea that they pretty much could easily lose everything that they're trying to save with just like one guy just fucking up. I mean, it's just so dumb. Oh, so dumb. This movie, yeah, I did not care for this at all.
Okay, and don't spend too much time on this next one, because hopefully we'll bring it back when it comes, because I think Josh, I know at least I want to see it. I'm assuming Josh will.
Oh, maybe well, not. Yeah, after the fun that we had with the Disaster Artist in the Room last year, absolutely.
Best Friend Fiends 2.
Yeah, Greg Sestero and Tommy Wiseau, part two of a story that I absolutely loved, and this one is not quite as good, but much like Deadpool 2 is not quite Deadpool for me, this one is just right below Best Friends, so it's they're close enough for me to go, yes, I enjoy this. I think there's proof here in this one that this is actually a genuine level of incompetence that's going on, and so that makes it kind of weirdly poignant and sweet, like, aw, you guys really tried. Tommy Wiseau. There's a moment in this that this may be my favorite thing I've ever described about a movie. That throughout this second part of Best Friends is basically like LARPers cosplaying No Country for Old Men. if you can imagine such a thing, that's what we get throughout most of the act, at middle, first and second act, even into the third act of Best Friends Part 2, which is absolutely hysterical. The first time you see Tommy Wiseau on screen in this movie is one of the biggest laughs I've had in a movie in a very, very long time. I laughed loud and I laughed long. It is such a bizarrely Tommy Wiseau entrance that I just couldn't get enough of it. It's so ridiculous. The whole thing is just, and the way this thing plays out is so remarkably unpredictable. And again, truly hysterical. They find the depths of silliness that you didn't even think they could get to, but they find it. Ah, it's amazing. I really do. I love the first one. I love this one nearly as much. It's gloriously silly nonsense.
Anything else on Best Friends 2?
June 1st and June 3rd in theaters. It's only going to play one time on June 1st and one time on June 3rd, and then I don't know what their plans for the future are. I'm sure they'll make it available on Blu-ray and DVD eventually.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed Classic.
Okay, our Undisputed Classic is a member of the Sight and Sound list. It's got a Criterion Collection, and it's called Sallow, 120 Days of Sodom.
Yes. Why did we do this to ourselves?
There's no we here. We've changed it so that we each get to pick the week of what's going on, and you had this week.
We agreed on this.
There's no we again.
Thought it was a good idea. Juxtapose Solo and Sallow. But Michael Greed is not really the
Michael
statement.
From Galesburg had, I'm not sure someone else's, but it had the Solo logo with Sallow.
Yes,
inside.
Yes.
We post that on our Facebook page.
This is Pier Paolo Pasolini, an Italian master. He made this movie back in 1975. He died a week after it was finished, murdered by a young man that he picked up at a... he tried to pick up for a sexual encounter that went so badly that he hit Pasolini with his car and then backed over him several times. Like, how is that not the perfect ending for Pier Paolo Pasolini based off what you see in this fucking movie? This is a... Four guys, the bishop, the president, the magistrate, and the governor, are in charge of this portion of Italy that during the fascist reign of Mussolini. And they kidnap a bunch of teenagers, take them to this country home, and spend a weekend torturing them in the most horrifying fashions imaginable. Sexual abuse, something called coprophagia, which we'll get to, and eventually bloody, deathly torture. And this is a Pasolini attempting to criticize the upper crust, the people with the power, and how power corrupts and how people abuse their power in the most extreme fashion. And it's based off of the actual written words of the Marquis de Sade. Who wrote this story back in the 1800s, but wasn't actually discovered until the early 1900s. And then it was published. It is a provocative movie. You are going to react. If you sit down and watch this, you're going to react to it. How you react to it is up to you. I think the production design is pretty spectacular. The cinematography is pretty incredible. Pasolini is a hell of a director. He's very bold. Do I think there's much beyond the provocation? I think it might be a little shallow. The metaphor for the powerful, the corruption of power is pretty obvious and not subtle in any way. But is there anything more to it? Does this have any depth? I'm not sure. I don't think it does.
It's a good question. I don't know about the depth portion of it, but I certainly felt the power of what the people in power were trying to do. Having so much power that you can have people do these terrible biddings for you, and then also still manage to, in the middle of a random story or whatever, take somebody into another room and rape them, or have them pee on you, or whatever the case may be. I guess that's a form of power. That's what I kept trying to go back to. Instead of thinking of what they were doing, what was the purpose of what these three individuals are doing? The president, the magistrate, and somebody else. I guess there was a fourth one, too. The film works for me in that these people have reached a level of abhorrence that I can't quite wrap my head around. And so I was trying to understand, does this have any relevance in our world today? Is it just somebody's mind... You know where I'm going,
oh, yeah.
I'm sure. Does it have any... Are there people like this? And I'm sure that there are. I won't go any farther than that. I'm sure that they are, and I'm sure that they're in power.
That P-tape's coming out.
Ultimately, what it comes down to is these people literally have no idea that they're evil. And mm-hmm. they're so enveloped in their particular world of power, substance... gosh, there's the Greek god Dionysus, you know, that idea of avarice and greed has reached a point where, a saturation point where you just become that thing.
It's as if they've grown so deplorable that they're trying to find where they can actually shock themselves.
Exactly.
And they've reached a level where they don't, there's nothing left for me to do to shock myself. And that's basically how the movie ends.
So I guess I'll become president.
Right. But, I mean, it reminds me of the, but there's also the, like, what was that Hitchcock movie? The Rope? Or whatever, the play. Where they were discussing, like, people actually believing they're better than other people.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely, they don't really necessarily go there, but that definitely exists with these main characters. And I think that's where a lot of people, they can get that abhorrent, is because they truly believe that. Mm-hmm. And it, I don't know, it's just a, I agree, I don't know that there's much more to it than that, but that's a lot. That's a big thing for me. It's something that has always bugged me about power in general, and it's why, like, and I'm going to bring up Eli Roth here for a second, because I think Hostel is such a great idea, which is very similar to this in a weird way, but he just fails completely with it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a terrifying idea of what that movie should have been, and it obviously wasn't, and then he also Cannibal Holocaust that he tried to take and fuck that up too. But I don't know. I don't want to watch the movie per se again. I'll happily show other people, or give it to other people to, we have a copy of it if anyone wants to borrow it.
Serve it to them on a platter.
We can all sign it, put it in a platter, and ship it to the winner. Because our signatures mean nothing, but it'd be fun.
The extreme narcissism of these characters. When you feel like there are no limits, you try and search and find the limit somewhere, and they don't find theirs. They just don't find a limit to what they're able to do.
Yeah, the casting is key in this film to me, because they chose young people that are, not only do they look younger than possibly their ages, which makes it more disturbing, mm-hmm, to watch, but they have a certain innocence in their eyes and fairness to their complexion that makes it that much more vicious when things happen to them. I struck a difference between those in power and those getting abused, mm-hmm, here. The ones in power, the four men, one of them looks exactly like Gerard Butler to me, which became like a massive problem. I kept seeing, like, this is Sparta, and he kept doing things to people, and it really bugged me.
So
he's the one
remake
that has the most significant scene in the film, and I kept seeing Gerard Butler. And then another one looks, he's so demented looking. He has something wrong with his eyes, whatever the case may be. He looked perverted the entire time. And I so badly wanted this film to kind of come around and have something happen to those in charge. Like there would be some kind of revolt. This film never lets up. Never. It never gives you the satisfaction of something like that happening. And so in the end, I'm kind of just like, what did I just watch? Because there's no catharsis to this. The catharsis is the depravity, I suppose. And you're supposed to feel, walking away from that, that power is the bad thing. So in other words, I'm considering this an important film in that I've never seen anything like it. And although it isn't as provocative to me as other things that I've seen, not as shocking as I was expecting, to be honest, it does make you think, because it doesn't give you that, like, oh, well, good thing it turned out okay. You know, it doesn't do that.
I think once you, you know, there's, when you talk about what's provocative and what somebody tells you about that scene that that happens, the 15 people, one cup, that scene comes up. I think that takes, that certainly, that allows you to sell, it allows you to steel yourself against it, so it becomes less shocking. The violence you've seen in other movies, that Circle of Blood doesn't really surprise me, because I've seen things in other movies that are just as bad, if not worse. You went from Cannibal Holocaust to Texas Chainsaw Massacre have done things that are that level of violence. You know, just last week, I think it was Jason from New Mexico posted on our page, Un Cien Andalou, the razor blade to the eyeball. you've seen something like that, it can steal you against what you see in Sallow. It's the way that Pasolini presents them that gives it the context for being more shocking and more provocative.
Yeah, and I mean, I know my wife literally did throw up watching this movie, so that probably doesn't help saying that, hey, this made someone throw up. And it really did. But but it does, yeah, I mean, one, the 15 girls, one platter, or whatever you want to call it. It's the title of the podcast, I guess. Probably not.
This was a show about Han Solo.
It's got to have Solo in it, of course. But
Solo and the 120 Days of Solo.
I think you start to get so, I don't know, it's like if you're being tortured, eventually your body just kind of gives in, and the pain isn't as bad as it was when it first started. And this movie kind of has that mixed with everything Sean just said. You've kind of seen some of the other stuff before. It seems more real to me than a lot of other movies. And because of that, and then just the idea of who would sign on for this movie. But then, I mean, people sign up for Human Centipedes. I mean,
right.
It's, I guess there are, I don't know. And then James Franco, you posted something where he reviewed it.
Yeah.
I thought it was neat that neither the writer of the book or the director got a chance to defend their movie, because they neither one of them were around when it kind of took a life of it or whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's an experience, I guess.
When you think about the things that informed Sallow and the things that Sallow goes on to influence, it does make you concerned that we're going to get used to way too much shit. Like, we're just getting used to things that are we should not be getting used to. And I mean, you take it to that political extreme, and I don't want to talk about left-wing politics too much, but when you take it to that extreme, and it's like you're no longer shocked by something, it could make you not react. You know, 1,500 children go missing in this country, and everybody's kind of like, well, hey, whose fault was that, right?
Paperwork.
Like, paperwork. I mean, here it's 18 children go missing and are tortured for an entire weekend. We don't know what happened to 1,500 children that were in this country that just kind of disappeared. I mean, could they be in some kind of Sallow scenario right now? That's horrifying. But we've become so blasé about everything, and it's stuff like what you see in Sallow, at least through the context, there's still something shocking about it, but the actual content, you're going, yeah, I think I've seen something like that before.
I suppose so. I don't necessarily know if a lot of us have become blasé about something like this. It's more along the lines of, what is it can we do? We feel a little helpless regarding it, and we expect those that are in power to perhaps take care of it, and at least go searching for it. Squads that can liberate children overseas. There's athletes that are involved in this kind of thing and trying to liberate people from overseas, kids especially. Right. But when your leaders are the ones manning the entire operation, it's kind of hard to feel like we can do anything about it. I can't say that I'm blasé about it. It's more along the lines of, I expected it to be a bit more visceral with the camera work. There's something about the director showing it for what it is, and you're serving something, okay, but it's also just like a regular dinner, so to speak. There's nothing necessarily jarring about that scene, other than unless you put that on yourself. And I'm looking at it from an angle, but I'm not necessarily reacted by it because of the way that the film was made.
What it is, the entire thing that Pasolini does, and it's an intended effect of passivity. It's impassive. It's something that's just, he wants you to not, he doesn't want you to invest in any of these characters. He doesn't want to create an emotional connection to them. He gives you their names occasionally, but no one speaks with any sort of passion. And the camera work especially is dispassionate. It's reserved. It's the exact opposite of like Toby Hooper in Texas Chainsaw, where you're right up in her eyes and you get the chainsaw swinging right past the camera. And that kind of stuff, it's an active terror. This is terror that's happening, but it's happening to you at a distance.
There we go. That's the difference. It's not necessarily less provocative. It's just more active versus passive horror.
And it's also forcing you more into the perspective of the people doing the evil, because they're just as passive as the camera is. Mm. even though they're the ones enacting it, they're doing it. Even their passion isn't all that passionate.
Yeah, so we have a copy.
Having been privy to the Marquis de Sade's work before, I saw a play in college called Marat Sade, and that was one of the most unique things I had ever seen. And I went on to watch the movie Quills, and I kind of read a bit more about the Marquis de Sade. And then I said, well, it's an interesting character or person in history because he's the first person to really show everyone their own demons, so to speak. But
and still such, I mean, do people even realize he's the basis for sadism, sadist? Anytime you use that, you're talking about the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah, good point.
What's your top five? Who's your top five?
Okay, so our top five this week is top five shitty movies. Because there's shit in this movie and they have to eat it. Not many of us, I guess we kind of were 50-50, I guess. Let's start here. Jason from New Mexico is looking forward to the jokes on this episode. I don't know. He had a couple, 15 girls, one couple, whatever it was. Okay, the hashtag game is strong. Oh, yeah, that's shouldn't just be reading every comment. Hoke. He had number five, Billy Madison, had a bag of poop in it, the emoji movie. Friday had that line where he said, not going to the bathroom. Two, Wrestling Vixens Unleashed. And number one, No Holds Barred. Uncle Jeff said, I'm going to be a party pooper and just list movies I hate rather than searching for movies containing or referencing excrement. So he had number five, Catwoman, with Halle Berry. Four, Alice in Wonderland with Johnny Depp. Number three, Clara's Heart, with Whoopi Goldberg and Neil Patrick Harris. Two, Pure Luck with Martin Short and Danny Glover. And then number one, Saving Christmas with Kirk Cameron. And then the rest is us. You want to go, Josh, or do you?
Yeah, sure. I'm prepared. Number five is Cannibal the Musical, Trey Parker and Matt Stone's piece of garbage. I hated every moment of that, and for a while, of course, contributed to me not wanting to be a part of watching South Park or anything that they did. I came around eventually because you can't escape some of their funny. Number four is The Lazarus Effect. We talked about that on this show, and it made me so angry I considered it briefly as the worst film I'd ever seen. Donald Glover is in that, oddly enough. Three is Soldier. I understand that some people find this to be very interesting, even though Kurt Russell says 25 words in the entire film. It's Paul W.S. Anderson's work. He is the worst active director that I can think of. And this is his worst film, even worse than Event Horizon. So number two is Mission to Mars. I hate that film with a strong passion. I got into an argument online with somebody about I'm watching a film that is great compared to Alien Covenant, and it was because I'm in an alien group or whatever, and so I called him to the floor and got kicked out of the group because he's an admin. And number one is Dan in Real Life. Why? It reminded me of Cheaper by the Dozen, something where you have a family dynamic and everyone just reacts instead of actually cares for each other. It's the most anti-family family film that I can think of, and it just really makes me mad how everyone comes down on Steve Carell's character for apparently no reason.
My list was number five, Bedtime Stories. Number four was sorry, hang on a second. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. Number three is Jack and Jill. Number two is Little Nicky. And number one is everything else Adam Sandler's ever touched.
Lazy.
Just kidding. My number one is Dogma because it has a shit monster and it's the best one.
Yes. I just went with movies I didn't like because I didn't want to. One, I forgot to do it. And two, I couldn't think of too many other than Dogma.
Oh, really, Bob? Oh, come on.
Yes, definitely. Interstellar is on my list. And because it should be good. And if it was, you know, it's, yes, you can throw the Adam Sandler movies and the David Spade movies, but those are easy. This one, you know they're not going to be good. This one was supposed to be great, and it was a disaster.
Plus, he can't figure out how Matthew McConaughey shit inside a Tesseract.
Right.
The ultimate vacuum.
That said, while I'm watching the trailer to Adrift, I'm like, this is what Nolan should be doing, because he made cooler waves in Interstellar than that's about the only thing the movie had that was. It looked good, but it was a shit piece of shit. The Canyons, I referred to as the worst movie of all time, also mentioned in the James Franco review of Salo.
Yeah, interestingly enough. He didn't like it either.
I'll throw Salo on there because it's so fresh. I didn't like that at all. 1517 to Paris was awful. And then Crash, another movie that should be great, but was just, you know, the Roger Ebert's big thing was, I don't remember what came out that year. I think it was...
Brokeback Mountain.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there was a like Deuce Bigelow or something like that was out. And Roger Ebert's big argument was, well, you can't clearly say this is worse than Deuce Bigelow. Yes, I can. Because I know Deuce Bigelow's not trying. They're just trying to make enough money or to satisfy their budget. This was trying, and it failed. So, no, it's worse than Deuce Bigelow.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
Two films in 1988 to talk about this week. Next week we'll have a much better opportunity to talk at length. Maybe that's a good thing or a bad thing. This time we have Rambo 3 and Crocodile Dundee Part 2. I'll start with Crocodile Dundee 2 because I didn't get a chance to see Rambo 3, and I feel very bad about it, and I want
Guess
you to have
what?
The fun.
I watched both.
Amazing. Crocodile Dundee Part 2, Paul Hogan, Linda Kozlowski, et al. are back in this one. He lives in New York City. She gets into some trouble with some terrorists because of her really terrible ex-husband that sends a piece of mail to her and gets her involved in all of this. And in the process, you've got Crocodile Dundee doing his Bugs Bunny thing, and he's going in and out of certain places to avoid terrorists and using all of the little backwoods things that he knows to free her and to kill these particular terrorists, played by the worst terrorist team of all time. Dude that's wearing a red sequin suit or something like that. It's just awful. And he's given monologues left and right. Paul Hogan is the star of this, of course, literally and figuratively. He's the only thing worth watching about this sequel. I enjoy the original, but when we watched that during its 30th anniversary, I remember thinking, well, boy, this really hasn't held up like maybe it should. And then there was all that interest in the Crocodile Dundee franchise earlier when Danny McBride and Chris Hemsworth and Paul Hogan made a tourism video for Australia. That reignited that interest for me. Watching the second part, I came to a conclusion that Paul Hogan and that character, maybe they were so popular because it's kind of like he was the last Marlboro man. That just kept flashing into my head.
You did say that.
There's a scene in which he takes a cigarette and he puts it out in the New York subway, and there was a slyness to what he was doing there that made me think, why is this so popular? Right, it's just an Australian dude doing like things that a random person, a woodsman, would do. It doesn't matter that he's Australian, right? Well, it's because he's embodying all of these things that people romanced about the Marlboro Man. He's resourceful. He's strong. You know, he'll romance your woman like crazy. He'll wear a cool hat with some sort of animal trophy on it. He's got boots. He's doing all the things that the standard Paula Cole song would want to talk about, right? Where have all the cowboys gone? Well, you didn't make a third Crocodile Dundee until 2001, and it failed. So the death of the Marlboro Man with Crocodile Dundee 2.
Wow. Paula Cole reference.
It's a fish out of water comedy. He's from the Outback. She's from New York. How will they ever fall in love?
Plot devices.
Fuck those movies.
Well, I mean, you're right. It's a Bugs Bunny character, but I think those characters always work. But I think this one is the worst of all of them, and I think most of them are good. But this one is just kind of. I get it's watchable, it's fun, but I would rather watch Riggs or Beverly Hills Cop or one of those movies than this. I don't know. It's It's just me, though.
There's something about Martin Riggs also being that last Marlboro man, perhaps. But he's such a fallible character, and eventually he comes around, you know, to finding the girl and getting better and not wanting to put a gun in his mouth anymore and having a kid.
Bugs Bunny wasn't suicidal.
Fair.
I mean, he still got into mischief for the next three movies, too. I don't know. But just kind of the, it's a fun character, I guess, but I don't know, it just didn't seem...
It was a thin premise that probably should not have gone beyond one movie.
Yeah, and stretched into three, with a possible fourth that had a germination of an idea. Also, Rambo 3, I feel very bad about not getting a chance to watch it this weekend.
I watched it.
Oh, take it away, guys!
I like Rambo 2 better. I mean, you can definitely see the steps to Rambo 4, or Rambo, whatever you're going to call it, from this one. But it wasn't as fun as Rambo 2 was. It was just cool, you know? I'm going to say cool things like, I'm your worst nightmare and stuff like that. But other than that, it just...
This is a flaming bag of garbage.
It's not that bad.
This is beyond dumb. This is so, like, to a point, like, it's almost irresponsible, the level of stupidity in this movie. Because they're exalting the wonderful people of Afghanistan who have beaten back the forces of Russia. Stallone did it himself, mostly. Mostly with Rambo doing it, but they also were there.
Well, at least they had the U.S.'s help.
They had Rambo's help.
And Oliver North.
This is so dumb. Like, Rambo dies basically like 15 times in this movie. It's just the cartoon physics involved in keeping him from dying in each of the various explosions that he's in are comical. I cannot watch that opening scene where he gets into the stick fight. Which is totally unnecessary. Plays no role in this movie whatsoever. It's like Stallone just said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stick fight. That's what how we're going to open the film? I'm going to stick fight. Why? I don't fucking care. I'm just going to stick fight. But I can't watch that, though, without seeing Charlie Sheen in Hot Shots 2.
Yeah, this is... Hot Shots Part 2 really was part of this. They took this movie more than any other movie. And that, no matter what, you can't even... let that.
Yeah.
I mean, even the war parts are from Hot Shots. The whole movie, you know, like Top Gun was Hot Shots. This one, I mean, I don't know why they pick. I mean, there's several movies in all of those, but this was the kind of the plot that it followed.
Is there a chicken involved? Like Hot Shots Part 2?
There may as well have been. It's about as believable that a chicken
took
would
the
blow
chicken
up.
Out. I mean, it's as believable as Fast and the Furious and Mission Impossible. It's okay, as silly okay. and stupid, and everybody survived that except for the actual actors sometimes. But I mean, it's just as silly as those are. So it was just a different era, you know. So I get why people like it, but it's not. I like Part 2's way more fun than this one was.
I discovered this weekend, searching for it on Amazon and ready to save it to a watch list, that there was, this is the greatest, I'm going to have to watch this somehow. There is a 65 episode long animated series called Rambo and the Freedom Force or something like that. Very serious, okay? And I badly want to watch it. I want to know how this escaped my memory. Is it supposed to be like for the older kids? Is it supposed to be for young kids? Because I remember buying a Rambo action figure in 1988 with his, he had, you know, no shirt on. He had all of the coolest weapons of any action figure that there possibly was, right? Like the longest gun and the biggest knife and everything. And I wondered if seeing that action figure and then seeing this, like the animated series, did they really market warfare to kids? Like G.I. Joe did, right? But this is like hardcore stuff.
I think I vaguely remember it. I feel like it was more goofy, but I don't know. I honestly can't remember. But I knew who Rambo was. And I think this was the first Rambo movie I saw as a kid.
It just seems very strange to take a rated R franchise and turn it into an animated show.
Oh, yeah.
To make toys for an R-rated movie is kind of weird.
Right. I mean, they did for Terminator 2. You know, like, I remember those toys very well. and they had turned it into a ride at Universal Studios and everything like that. But for Rambo, that's like, I always saw that as very strange that they would have toys for it. And my dad was like, yeah, that's cool. That's a cool figure.
It just demonstrates, though, the mercenary nature of this, like the paycheck pickup mercenary nature of making another Rambo movie. We're doing the Rambo 3, Back for the Cash.
It did very well for itself.
Yeah, but I mean, we could say about literally every sequel to every movie that ever existed, including the Avengers series. I mean, they're all... I mean, you can dismiss anything to that if you really want to. That's the one thing that you could tell that... Like, it just wasn't as fun. It wasn't as... Like, it was goofy in that, you know, he's not getting killed, but neither did Han Solo, you know, neither did... You know, Tom Cruise is still Ethan Hunt's doing just fine, and he probably should have died several times over as well. But it just like he was trying too hard to be just cool than fun. Like, just, I bet this is going to look neat, you know, this fight scene and this the way I'm holding a gun, the way I'm pulling this thing out of my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, it seemed like they were going for that. You know, how we always, Stallone never put a shirt on in the 80s. And it was just more cool images that they were going for than actual fun.
It's all about Sylvester Stallone stroking his own ego live on screen. He's just basically masturbating himself on screen. Look how great I am. Look what great shape I am. Look how cool I am. But I'm also a monk. Like, I go to stick fight, but I can also be a monk. And then I'm the baddest fighter in the world. Then I can take out an entire division of the Russian army by myself.
The American dream, man.
But he does. I mean, all his movies have been stroking his ego. But Rambo 2 was fun. Rocky 4 is a blast. Rocky 3 is fun. Demolition Man's. I mean, he sometimes when he strokes his ego, he makes it fun. So I don't know what the deal was with this one. But it was just like he was trying to be too serious or something like that. I don't know.
I think just the Rambo aesthetic just doesn't translate to that very well. It just doesn't. The origin of the character is so serious and so down to earth. It's that you try and turn it into this massive superhero cartoon. It becomes that much more silly and that much more sad.
I'll stand by Rocky Rambo 2. I mean, well, Rocky 2 as well. Rocky was serious and they went goofy with it. Rambo started off serious and not even as good, and then. Part 2 was a lot of fun. Josh and I both had a lot of fun with that movie.
Absolutely. It had the bare bones of James Cameron writing that screenplay and everything.
And then you could see like literally every story James Cameron ever did come out of that movie.
Not wrong.
Except for Titanic, maybe.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't want to dismiss Rambo 3, but anyway. Anything else before we need to end? All right, next week, what's coming out next week? Is that a Drift?
Yeah.
Is that it?
It's a Drift. It's a Upgrade and Action Point.
Yes, what is Action Point?
Action Point is the Jackass crew running it.
That
running
is correct. A, yeah. That makes sense because our classic next week is not Jackass, it's the Poseidon Adventure. And our top five is top five biggest Jackass characters in movies. Not necessarily the characters from Jackass, but characters you found to be jackasses.
And then that's based it's based on the same thing that that the Dollop did, Action Point in New Jersey. It's based on that same story.
I will, like, I'll never admit to liking the Jackass stuff, but whenever I see it, it's hard not to laugh at some of the things they do. Even the trailer for this, some of the, it's just stupidity, but it's just like, it's kind of funny sometimes. I don't know.
Sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. I remember enjoying, to a certain extent, The Ringer, one of his films that was like 2009, 2010, something like that. And I was predicated to really hate the Jackass crew at that point. Everything that came out of MTV, I said no, 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 1,000 times no. And then that one still somehow got me a little bit. Maybe this works.
Well, that was the thing, is I said no, but without ever really watching it. And then all of a sudden I'd see something and I'd be like, and I just would force a laugh out of me that I couldn't hold back no matter how hard I tried.
Sure.
Yeah, the Jackass movies definitely have that guilty pleasure appeal of watching someone hurt them, get hurt, but do so intentionally. Like, I know I'm going to get hurt, but I want you to laugh at this at the same time. Like, this is going to be really funny when I do get hurt.
Yeah, like, I don't know why, but that big hand in part, was it part three? It was in the trailer. I don't even saw the movie, but Bam Margera or whatever was walking into the room. He's got a cup of coffee, and they just smack this life, like a hand the size of three of us.
Yeah.
Like in a slingshot fashion, and hits him and knocks him over. And I don't know why that's funny, but it's funny.
Really? I bet I could watch that happen to him over and over again.
But that's all these movies are, is these idiots getting their just stupid shit happening to them.
And so put it on mute and watch it is what you're saying.
Well, part of them laughing at it adds
it's
to it.
It's infectious, yeah.
It's hard to explain because I'm like you. I don't want to like these movies, but even watching this trailer, some of the stuff they're doing is
even
just,
now, like years later, I can flash back in my mind to watching Steve-O intentionally letting a snake bite him on the ass, and it makes me laugh. Just watching him and Chris Pontius just trade off, just getting bit by worse and worse animals is hilarious to me.
No, what's not funny is him stapling his nuts to it. Like that, saying it out loud, I guess, is funny. Who's a stand-up comedian where he'd walk around and that would be a show? He'd pull his nuts out and staple himself. Like that, and it was just more of a, ugh, that was the reaction he was getting than a laugh.
Right.
But I don't know. It's
ow.
And he would do it night after night.
Like when you're a teenager, the idea of like golf cart demolition derby is hilarious. And watching a group of mostly adults do that, but acting like kids and running into each other and crashing and nearly killing themselves, it makes me laugh every time I see it.
I have done golf cart demolition derby to an extent.
How old were you?
23.
That's the thing. It's like when I watched the trailer for this, what's it called again? Action Point?
Action Point.
These guys are older than us.
Yeah.
And I hurt just being existing.
Waking up.
So I can't imagine a 45-year-old, 50-year-old, whatever, doing the shit they're doing.
Well, considering all the things that Johnny Knoxville's done to himself already. He was gored in the balls by a bull.
Oh,
he said multiple injuries to every area of his body, and he was injured during this movie. I think the scene's in the trailer. Actually, he gets slingshotted through that barn. He really did hurt himself there.
That's what's funny too. And I laughed just as hard at the Fallout trailer where Tom Cruise, they show him getting hurt, jumping to the... hilarious. Anyway, that's our show. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. We'll start out with Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing, our key grip. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Special effect level, Corey.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Seavers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
And if you want to be a Patreon supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon is the best way to help the podcast out. Get a credit on the show, get a shout out on the show, and other things that we sometimes do. Am I forgetting anything? Oh, iTunes, subscribe there, rate and review the show. And I think that's it. We'll see you next week with those movies.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. The friends, the three best friends that anybody...
All right. Bad Santa, Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society.
I agree. The Thing, 1982 or 7?
Ooh. 7.
Be still my beating. I would consult my list, but I don't have time for it. It's The Thing. It's got to be.
It's 7, but just because of the way when I saw it. The Big Lebowski or Strangers
Big
on
Lebowski.
A Train?
Big Lebowski.
Yeah. Bad Boys or Doctor Strangelove, How I Learned This.
Doctor Strangelove.
Doctor Strangelove.
Home Alone, Mars Attacks.
Home Alone.
Mars Attacks. I watched that one again for the first time since the theater.
I'm going with Mars Attacks.
And that is way funnier than I remember it being.
The Terminator, or we're going to get rid of Super Size Me because documentaries shouldn't compete. The Terminator or The Graduate?
The Graduate.
Terminator.
Captain America, The First Avenger, or Shallow Hal?
Captain America.
Captain.
I love Shallow Hal, though.
Me too. That was kind of fun. Transformers or District 9?
District 9.
Yes! District 9.
That's how bad Transformers is.
Glad you stuck around. Serenity or Dude, Where's My Car?
Serenity.
Serenity. It's a better Han Solo movie.
Animal House or Gone with the Wind?
Animal House.
Gone with the Wind.
It's Animal House. I can't not think of homework. Speaking of homework, Hotel Rwanda or Munich?
Munich.
Yeah. The Simpsons movie, As Good as It Gets.
Simpsons movie.
Simpsons.
I'll say As Good as It Gets. Burn After Reading, Underworld.
Burn After Reading.
Last Action Hero, Romeo and Juliet, 96.
Romeo and Juliet.
Agreed.
Fine. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Casablanca.
Casablanca.
Shaun of the Dead, Varsity Blues.
Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
Varsity Blues by a mile for me.
I don't love Shaun of the Dead, but Varsity Blues kind of sucks.
So. Oh, it's so much fun.
Varsity Blues has really one good scene. So I'll take Shaun of the Dead.
It's got several good scenes. It got the Foo Fighters playing My Hero. Over choreographed football. It's amazing.
Whipped cream.
Well, that's my... Yes. And that's our show, because we're done.